and creative and professional writing. He currently teaches the history of the arts and humanities in the liberal studies department at OU, and Introduction to Songwriting at Austin Community College. Oh yes, he is a songwriter and sings and accompanies his own songs on the guitar. He also writes poetry, and he's the author of 9 books. Karma Crisis, New and Selected Poems, is one I read, and it's kind of a collection over a period of time, right? Several. And it's wonderful. It's like little short stories, little jewels, little succinct periods. And his latest book is Less is More, More is Less. I think he may have some copies now. As a professional songwriter and musician, he has performed in venues from Oklahoma City, Nashville, and Austin, as well as Israel and Russia. And his most recent album, yes, music album, Gypsy Moon, was recorded in Austin. He's currently the Poet Laureate of Oklahoma. He travels widely, giving concerts, readings, creativity workshops, musical performances, in order to, and I quote, to bring back the hint of a smile and the hope for a good story in poems. Poems unafraid of making sense. Poems that carry us to better places. So, Dr. Brown will talk to us about how our world is bogged down in masses and messes, your words, of text with useless and worthless information, which grows exponentially daily. So how do we make sense out of it all? Dr. Brown will try to show us in his talk the power of brevity, the role of poetry in a world of too many words. And so without any further ado, help me welcome Dr. Nathan Brown.
I'm now that you've read that actually out loud, I'm suddenly daunted by my task, and so I'm going to give this my best shot here. Thank you so much. We were talking a little bit about weather earlier, and that some folks might not be getting out tonight because of weather. And my best friend in the world who does all of my book, he's a graphic designer who does my book covers for me, lives in Minneapolis. And the folks in Minneapolis right now are laughing at us down here for being in a tizzy about a little ice. They've gone 10, 12 days in a row without getting above zero in Minneapolis. So they're kind of like, yeah, whatever. I do hope it kind of holds out for me tonight, because I have to drive back to Oklahoma tonight. Because I have an appearance in Oklahoma City tomorrow. So here's hoping that I-35 will be my friend tonight. Thank you very much. And David, I'm still not exactly sure how you found out about me. Did we ever discuss that?
I found out about you through Jenny.
Okay, well, thank you, Jenny.
Thank
you so much. And I am very grateful to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very, very passionate about poetry. Anyone who jumps into a full-time life and existence of dealing with poetry has to love it, because it is the least popular and least fiscally remunerative sport in the literary world. But I love poetry, and there is a reason that I love poetry, and I'm going to try to quickly express that to you tonight. A while back, Garrison Keillor, who, by the way, has done a lot for the cause of poetry in the United States. I'll be very clear about this, whether you like him or not. And, you know, some people can't take his voice. Some people adore it. He's just one of those kind of polarizing characters. I can tell you right now that the academic poetry community does not like Garrison Keillor at all. They come down on him pretty hard, and in many ways. I'm a defender of his. Here's one of the reasons why. He said this in an article a while back. The reading aloud of poetry has been shown time and time again to be very effective at breaking up gatherings of people. Many police departments now, instead of using tear gas or pepper spray, just break out T.S. Eliot and Wordsworth. Well, I'm going to follow that with a quote from a poet, a Native American. He's an Oklahoman. I love this guy. His name is Richard Ray. He's a Native American actor, poet, and activist. He's an incredible guy. Richard Ray said one of my favorite things I've ever heard about poetry. He said, just because people don't understand you, it doesn't mean you're a poet. You see, these quotes have to be answered. There has to be an answer to this if you want to be a poet. I'm going to give one final illustration on this side of the fence, and then I'm going to begin to try to cross over to the other side of the fence of why I still love poetry anyway, in spite of itself, is what I sometimes say. Some of you may know, we were talking at the table here earlier about Larry McMurtry, the Texas author who wrote Lonesome Dove and Last Picture Show and Tender Mercies, and as a matter of fact, has written so many books. And is still writing, by the way. Recently came out with a new book. Uh-oh, I'm entering the light show phase. There we go. Maybe I shouldn't touch this. See if I can get away with that. And Larry McMurtry, the reason that, I've not spent a lot of time with Larry, but Larry McMurtry's son, James McMurtry, is a good friend of mine and someone that I consider to be one of the best songwriters out there right now. As a matter of fact, I consider James McMurtry a poet. He would be very uncomfortable with me saying that. But he is incredible. And he's one of those musicians, he's one of those songwriters whose most famous songs might cause you to discount him. But the thing is that his most incredible lyrics, his most astounding poems that he's written are his lesser known songs, the one that people aren't as familiar with. He's an amazing poet, and James is a good friend of mine. And I want to tell you something. Here's my third comment from the Garrison Keillor side of the fence. James and I were sitting one night on the back steps of the Continental Club in Austin, one of America's most famous music joints. And he had just finished a late night concert. It was probably 1 or 2 in the morning. And we were sitting on the back steps, and I think we were maybe on our third glass of Malbec. So we were almost there. And James knew that I had been a songwriter for the first half of my life, and that I had become a poet over time. So that, in other words, he knew that I had left the lucrative life of songwriting and being a folk musician for the incredible life of a poet. And James swirled his Malbec around and stared down at his glass, and he said, "My God, you found the only step down." Now, if you think about it, he wasn't paying himself a big compliment. He said, as a songwriter, I'm not worth much more. But it's a fun thing. And by the way, I recently came out with a book called, as Oklahoma Poet Laureate, it's interesting, to be from Longview, Texas, to live in Oklahoma for a long time, be the Oklahoma Poet Laureate, and now live in Wimberley, Texas. What I have discovered is that now neither state will have me. Texas won't have me because I lived in Oklahoma too long, and Oklahoma won't have me anymore because I was born in Texas and now live here. And James, a verse from one of his songs actually made it into this collection of poems that I put together for my laureateship there in Oklahoma called Oklahoma Poems and Their Poets. A verse from one of his songs that was just so incredible that I actually considered it poetry. It is the only song lyric in the book, by the way. And so one of the things that we're dealing with right now is one of the problems that we have is that we do not recognize that some of our best poets writing right now are Americana songwriters. Period. Some of the best words we have. Sam Baker. I could start throwing around names. Sam is a friend of mine. John D. Graham has songs that rip me to shreds. Most of these guys are based in Austin, but not all of them. And so this is a part of what we're dealing with. Let me give you a quick rundown. If a U.S. poet laureate, a guy that Jenny and I were talking about earlier named Billy Collins, I refer to Billy Collins as a gateway poet. If you want to come back to poetry, Billy Collins is a fantastic place to start. I always tell people that the first hit of Billy Collins is free. He is so incredible, and I love him and his stuff. But Billy Collins was one of the very few people to have two terms as U.S. Poet Laureate. He was a two-time U.S. Poet Laureate. And I want you to think about the fact that at one point, the U.S. Poet Laureate, while he was U.S. Poet Laureate, said this. 83% of American poetry is not worth reading. Well, of course, he pulled that number out of the, you know, because of Americans' love for numbers. So he chose a weird one. Instead of saying 70, it was like, I think 83. My opinion might be closer to 90. And I say this because I went to, as the Brits might say, I attended university for 23 years, which is actually more sad than it is impressive. I did wind up with a PhD eventually, but I tell people that I believe it might have been a PhD of attrition. The president of the university there at OU, David Boren, just was like, oh, good grief, just give it to him and get him out of here. But I went to school for a long time, and I devoted an incredible amount of my life to the study of poetry. And what I would say is something very much along the lines of what one of my favorite poets, second unto Billy Collins, I would say Stephen Dunn, is one of my favorite living poets who's still writing. Stephen Dunn is a bit of a pen pal of mine. I'm grateful for the relationship. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. Listen to what he said. He said, I've devoted my entire life to the study of poetry. So if I read a poem and I don't understand it, he has little patience for deliberate obtuseness, as I heard him say one time. Well, I'm going to give my extremely unorthodox, where academicians would rip me to shreds, incredibly brief take on what happened to American poetry and why it is that fewer people read it now than ever. 50 to 70 years ago, give or take, poetry walked away from the reader. I'm speaking particularly, by the way, of American English poetry right now. It walked away from readers and most audiences. It crawled into the halls there below the English departments, into the basements, and eventually made its way up to the very top of the ivory tower, where there is a severe lack of oxygen, by the way. It became very concerned with itself and keeping up the appearance of profundity. The lack of oxygen and concern for the approval of academic colleagues over a period of decades eventually led poetry off into realms of the esoteric, seldom attained in the arts, save maybe Duchamp's Turner Prize-winning urinal. I don't want to get into it. I've argued that one so many times that I don't even know how to... Now, with that said, okay, And because of the brevity issue here tonight, I want to jump into this quickly. I want to say that for the past decade or two, there has been a concerted effort on the part of some poets to move back towards the audience. By the way, David and Jenny and I were talking earlier about what are the arts, you know, if there's no interest in any connection whatsoever to the audience. Now, I fully realize that, you know, and by the way, because I work with undergraduate college students in creative writing, I can tell you that there is a definite defense for not caring about the audience. They frequently say it with hands on hips, explaining to me why it is they don't want to make any sense. And I said, well, that's great. And I'm sure your mother will buy your book. And I've gotten to where I'm about to turn 50, and so I feel like I have finally reached the age where I have earned the right to be cranky with my students. And I've done it a little bit. However, I will say this. There has been an effort on the part of some American poets. I've already mentioned a couple of names. Billy Collins, Stephen Dunn. I might go on to say Kay Ryan, Naomi Shihab Nye, San Antonio, Texas, a fantastic poet. If you have not read her work, you would absolutely love it. She's also just absolutely one of the most delightful people I have ever met. She's incredible. Tony Hoagland out of Houston, a phenomenal poet, who I may quote a little later when I take a peek at a book. Ted Kooser and Sharon Olds, who, by the way, makes me writhe in discomfort sometimes when I read her poetry. She is so incredible. She actually makes me uncomfortable. These poets have made an effort to move back towards the audience. They want to connect. By the way, when I speak at universities, I will sometimes actually look out at the professors in the crowd and say, before I get too far into this, I want to go ahead and admit to you that I have a weakness for wanting to be understood. Now I want you to listen to, and let me see if I can quickly, I'm going to zoom way to the end of something here. And, well, I went right past it. Good grief. Let's see if I can call it back. And I'm going to go to the end here. A quote from Salman Rushdie. A poet's work is to name the unnameable, to point at frauds, to take sides, start arguments, shape the world, and stop it from going to sleep. I'm going to make a statement that has been very unpopular with academic poets, a statement that I have made that I have actually had university professors walk out on me. Deliberately obtuse, abstract, nonsensical poetry is never going to do one of those things. Not ever. And this is coming from a guy who spent over a decade of his life under full detail security because he has a warrant out for his death by the Islamists. He still lives with bodyguards, by the way, I think, at this point. Now, let me come back in defense of poetry. William Carlos Williams. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. I still believe it's true. And if Billy Collins is right, when he said that 83% of American poetry is not worth reading, nobody listened to what he said right after that. They only paid attention to that very controversial claim. What he said right after that was, but that 13%, I cannot live without. That's actually much more important. He said 83% of American poetry is not worth reading, but that 13% I can't live without. I'll throw out yet another name, William Stafford. William Stafford, by the way, is an American poet He was the Oregon Poet Laureate and U.S. Poet Laureate both for a while. He died in 1994. His daughter, Kit Stafford, has become kind of a friend of mine. I've been grateful to know her. And William Stafford actually inspired an entire book of mine that is entirely based on the subject of brevity. It's called Less is More, More or Less. This book was written as a result of a challenge that a friend gave to me that came from a quote from William Stafford. And here was his quote. Now we're going to enter what I was going to say about brevity. And the reason that poetry, we do need to find our way to the good poetry. And here is the beginning of the reason why. Here's two lines from a William Stafford poem that inspired this entire book that I wrote. You don't need many words if you already know what you're talking about. It sounds more like a threat than a suggestion. And what that inspired was a friend telling me, this is a little bit smaller book than I normally do. It's a 5x7 book. The entire basis for the writing of this book is that no poem in this book can be longer than a 5x7 page. It had to fit on a 5x7 page or it doesn't go in. I tell people that basically what it turned out was an exercise in extended haiku was what it was. It was probably one of the single best learning experiences I have ever had when it comes to the art of communication and how we get through. The bottom line is that we live in a day and age of way too many words. A glut of information, much of it useless, much of it worthless information. And it's on the sides of buses, it's on every screen that we carry with us, iPhones, laptops, computers, televisions. Look at the way that the news screen has changed in the last 50 years. We used to have Walter Cronkite on the screen, maybe with his name underneath him. What do we have on a news screen now? We have the news anchor with the three people he's talking to above his head, a sidebar with the weatherman over here going, telling us where the highs are, and how we're going to die on the roads tonight. And then at the bottom of the screen, three scrolling bars of information. One of them being, the stock market, and one of them being who murdered who today. It's a single screen. And I, who grew up in the generation who encountered the world before computers, I basically at 50, I grew up with the computer generation from its absolute start. And what I'm saying is that it's when we live in a world now where there are 300,000 to 400,000 books are published a year. Okay? What do we do with that? And by the way, if you're a writer, what in the world are you going to do to stand out in the crowd if you ever want to sell a book? Be obtuse? Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. I have actually had publishers from New York to Chicago to LA tell me, don't ever put Dr. Nathan Brown on your book cover.
That's right.
No one will buy your book. It's a fascinating time that we live in. And so what is the poet's job now? I have come to believe, and many of the names I gave you earlier are people who are masters of this, it's basically finding and fitting the best words possible into the smallest amount of space. In other words, what is it that poetry has to offer us when it's great, and there is great poetry out there? Very quickly, just off the top, I want to read you a very, very short Billy Collins poem, since I have profaned his name so many times now, that he wrote about driving past his parents' graveyard, the cemetery where his parents are buried. I thought I had it marked. I do apologize. Hang on. Let me get it. It's very short, and it's there, and it's also worth it. Here we go. Now, this is not, you know, profound, highly philosophical, or and yet maybe. No time. In a rush this weekday morning, I tap the horn as I speed past the cemetery where my parents lie buried, side by side under a smooth slab of granite. Then, all day long, I think of him rising up to give me that look of knowing disapproval while my mother calmly tells him to lie back down. Our parents never leave us. It's, you know, I've been staying with my parents recently and I have to drive back to their house in Norman, Oklahoma tonight. And my mom is 83 and still packs, you know, food for me on my trips and still worries, still checks the weather on her iPhone for whether or not I'm going to be in trouble as I'm driving where I've driven for a livelihood for almost 30 years now. So it's this art of brevity. What I want to do is I want to zip through, I want to show just how short poems can be. Just a couple of, since they are so short, I think you might be able to survive this. I'm going to read a few poems from this little, the Book of Tiny Poems. There are four chapters in the book. The first chapter is called But Enough About Me. And it comes with a quote from Tony Hoagland, one of his poems, who's one of the names I mentioned earlier, a poet who's worth your time. Two lines from his poem. I think narcissism is the system that means the most to me. There's some philosophy. Presbyopia. Words on the page now require an extra foot or so from my eyes for me to find them. Just the latest in a long line of lovers to politely and apologetically distance herself from me. Burnout. Those days come, days when the old dirty light bulb that swings in my brain only flickers and buzzes. I screw it tighter, tap it with a calloused finger, but get little to no light. Traveler. I leave more places than I arrive to in the end. So I wonder where that puts me on the map. Local star. He's still as good as he ever was. That's why he's still where he is. Now, the first thing I'll tell you in creative writing is don't ever write poems about poetry and poets and writing. So I had devoted an entire chapter of this book to that. Ars Poetica, Poems and Their Problems. And by the way, this chapter begins with the quote from Richard Ray, just because people don't understand you, it doesn't mean you're a poet. Voices. They have teeth, worn and polished from years of use, a tongue just as lethal, but your critics would not love you if you changed. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is like a freshly fallen coconut. There is milk, even meat, inside, but getting to it is the damnedest thing. I marked this one particularly for the philosophers tonight. The title of this poem is Antisthenes, one of my favorite Greeks. And it begins with a quote from Adam Zagajewski, a Polish poet who, by the way, I would rate with Billy Collins and all of the others I Adam Zagajewski. He's a fantastic poet. And by the way, his greatest book is called Mysticism for Beginners. Antisthenes. It's very short. Cynics are not pessimists. They just prefer to shrewdly minimalize their optimism. Yes, those are very, very short poems. But what it was is that book was a learning tool for me. It was a lesson. It was a lesson. Cut the fluff. Get to what you want to say. We have, by the way, especially poets, we have such limited attention. Can we just turn it off? That's going to hurt somebody. My dad is a Baptist preacher, and so I have a penchant for watching the clock. So what I would like to do is just close with a couple of poems because they've been mentioned tonight, and then I'm going to, I don't know, is there a question and answer time, or do we just hang out? I think I've made my point about there is a use for brevity now. There is an importance to getting to it, for cutting down to the very core of what you want to say. I think it's extraordinarily more important now than it's ever been. And I really do feel like that the great poets, the ones that are writing for the audience and who do want to connect with us, are doing this incredibly well, and they are worth your time. I'm going to read just a couple of poems because they were mentioned tonight by a couple of folks who are here, and I kind of wanted to read them for them. The first one is for my... These are about the great women in my life. The first one is for my Grandma Brown, who lived most of her life in South and then Southwest Oklahoma. She was born in Maud, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Bowlegs, Oklahoma. This is true. And she lived most of her life in Sorrel, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Cement, Oklahoma. And if you say cement, no one will know what you're talking about. It's cement. Grandma. Boy, she hollered at me, come on in out from under that car, it's time for lunch. And I cocked my head and counted, on in, out from under. I was awed by her ability with language and still full from breakfast. And I thought, now who else could do that? Just rattle out 5 prepositions in a row without even thinking about it. And somehow I knew what she meant. I watched oil creep down my hand and I pondered my degree in linguistics. All those textbooks and phonetic symbols and grandma, a total mystery. Like when I was 8 years old and she took me out to the garden through a banging screen door to show me our supper all growed up out of God's ground. I took that phrase to my linguistics professor, on in, out from under, and man, he thought that was so incredible, and he attacked the chalkboard, you know, and after about 10 minutes there was more chalk on the board than board, and he kind of backed away from the board after a while. And I'm not kidding, that one of my favorite professors of my entire illustrious 23-year career as a student backed away from the board and looked at it and scratched his chin and went, no. That was it. My grandma had totally stumped the linguistics professor, and it was incredible. Very quickly, now that was grandma, now one for my mother. As the minister of propriety and fermentation. So mom hands me the list, handwritten on the back of church stationery, with a wince of hope in her eyes. KJ2 is code for a couple of Kendall Jackson Chardonnays, Vintner's Reserve. It's her favorite. Then down below that, champagne. 1 Andre X Dry, 1 Behringer Pink, if enough money. And she handed that list to me because she is a preacher's wife. Even if that preacher retired years ago, this is just how it's done on the plains of Oklahoma, folks. Liberated as she may be, a temperate, upstanding woman married to a Baptist minister enlists an accomplice, someone beyond redemption, to buy her booze. And then I must read one for my daughter, and then one after that that is to the critics of the world. These are my two favorites. So and then we'll be done here. For my daughter, this one goes by very quickly. You'll see why here in a second. It's called. By the way, I have my daughter's permission to read this poem. Now, it's very important that you know that when you hear the title, 13 Going on Cougar. Lindsay's awesome. Boys of the Problem said, Jesse, he's cool. A band practice the other day anyway. We can't ever get anything done. Matt sucks, and I get a C if I don't turn this in tomorrow. Please, Dad, it's got to be there. It was just a kiss. He's so shy. I always have to make the first move. Oh, that's just Ashley. She's just like that. Ooh, I love this song. Turn it back to 104.1. Can we get a burrito? And I'm serious. Mr. Jackson only likes Asian students. Jody got caught with pot and snow the other day in the bathroom. But anyway, like I was saying, boys of the problem. I mean, the whole freaking problem. OMG, WTF. That constitutes a conversation with my daughter. And by the way, if poetry is a celebration of language, which is one of the things that it should be, my daughter is a celebration of language. It's true. She's a celebration of language. It's exploding out of her. And I would never want to quiet that, even though I couldn't, actually, even if I tried. I'll end with this poem here. It's my final word to the critics. I've always wondered how critics get their job. You know, does the queen put a sword on each shoulder? And you know, I dub thee qualified now to destroy people's careers. And you know, I'm not sure. It's a curious thing. I do know, I'm going to be specific to the creative writing world. Are there any creative writing professors here? Just philosophers? Let me be exclusive then and just say creative writing department, because I don't want to talk about any other departments. I have noticed something about critics. They tend to be failed artists. So here's my word to the critics. I decided that I could be a critic too. And by the way, if you have ever been critiqued, you'll know that there's a difference between being critiqued and being critiqued. They're two very different things. One is useful and one is not. So I chose a work of art and an artist, and I critiqued him. Dear God, I have always admired your work, and were it not for that, I wouldn't bother you with this, but I must say that your installation piece at Point Lobos Nature Reserve above Big Sur in California simply goes too far. The Monterey pines are too tall. Cypresses are too fanned out in perfection from trunks tied in intricate knots that would take centuries to unravel. The cliffs appear superimposed just for dramatic effect, with impossible jags giving away to fairy tale caves that burst forth gushes of blue water like a French soda topped with a spray of whipped cream. The crash of waves and explosions of foam are too much like a Disneyland ride. There are too many kinds of birds, too many varieties of plants, and too much color in both, I might add. In short, it lacks integrity. It does not speak to the truth of the way things are, and I don't think that viewers will trust or believe its authenticity. Thank you all so much. I appreciate it.
We have time for some questions now, Dr. Brown.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Excellent presentation. I was just wondering, how does one become a poet laureate of a state? Is there like the top poets of Oklahoma all get together and vote, or the governor, or how does that happen?
It's a strange process that I was not familiar with at all. You have to be nominated by an organization. This is Oklahoma. Now, I have three or four good friends who are Texas poet laureates, wonderful poets. By the way, I think Alan Berkelblatt may have spoken to you all at one point, and Alan is a good friend. Alan gave me one of my favorite quotes about becoming a poet laureate, of anyone at all. He said, it changes nothing, and it changes everything. And I figured out what he meant. It was exactly right. He was exactly right. You are nominated by an organization. You can't be nominated by an individual. The literary magazine out of OU called World Literature Today, that's been around for about 75 years now, very respected for its reviews, literary reviews, and the Newstad Prize, second or third largest literary prize in the world, is given out at the University of Oklahoma, the Newstad Prize. Here's an interesting statistic. 60% of the people who win the Newstad Prize at OU go on to win the Nobel eventually. And they nominated me, and it went to the Oklahoma Humanities Council, which, by the way, is the reason that I put together this anthology of poems. These are poems about Oklahoma. By the way, there are three Texas poet laureates with poems about Oklahoma in here. It's an unusual book. But all of the profits and proceeds from the sale of this book go to the Humanities Council. They forward their top five nominations on to the governor's office, which I did not realize makes somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 4,000 appointments in their tenure. And so I have to say, it's a total mystery to me how I just got the call and said thank you. And obviously the governor has not read my more political poems. And so for 2 years I kept my mouth shut. I don't know how it works in Texas, but it's a pretty mysterious process in Oklahoma. It's not easy, but I found out. There have been three Pulitzer Prize winners who have been Poet Laureate of Oklahoma. So I was quite honored. I was quite honored. And I'm grateful.
You can see what I said about his poetry is like a little short story, like a little jewel of a short little jewel of a story with an aha ending. My question is, how do you get that, or is that important, that kind of aha point, you know, feeling with poetry?
Okay. You know, I mentioned a lot of names tonight, and if someone actually tries to peg me with who is your favorite poet writing, it is actually a clear answer for me. It's Stephen Dunn. I think that Stephen Dunn, Stephen Dunn, he's astounding. And I love what he said. He has been at it so long, and he's so good. He says that he can read a poem and see the point at which the poet discovered what the poem is about. He can see it in the poem when the poet was writing and said, oh, that's what I'm doing. And he said that the mistake that most poets make is that they don't go back and take out what's before it. And it's incredible advice, but it is definitely that. It is that. That's the point that I always look for when I'm writing. It's the aha point where you go, oh, that's what I'm doing. And that's what I'm always after. Always, and I completely go off course.
This is out of some ignorance, I'm sure, but I wondered what the difference is between some of your very shortest poems and what we might call an aphorism.
Right. I really do think many of those really short poems that I read tonight could be. I was just really trying to see what it would take to get it down to the absolute fewest words possible. So I think, could I make a distinction between... that's a tough question, because I'm not going to say necessarily that they might not be aphoristic, you know, definitely. But what I do think is that the good aphorism and the good poem are sort of after the same thing. It's just that some poems are a little longer and try to hash it out a little more. But I by no means, there are fantastic aphorisms. You know, Mark Twain's, the difference between the good word and the best word or something like that is the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. Aphorism or poem, I don't care. It's fantastic. It's just fantastic. And so I'm kind of okay with however it, you know, it works out. But I think aphorisms are great. I'm a quotation fanatic. I collect them. They are all over my books. I use them all. I love them. Yeah.
Enjoyed your talk very much.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, how much time do you spend, or are you very drawn to go back to old poems and rewrite them, rework them? Do you do a lot of that or not very much? And when you do it, do you find yourself chopping away a lot of it, or just really rewording it, or is it kind of both?
I'm a hacker. I chop poems like, I mean, I, and I, the, here's what I would say. I have written a poem a day for the last 17 years. I don't miss. If I do, for some reason, miss, I have to write two poems the next day. That's the rule. So I have a poem for every calendar day of the year for the last 17 years. So what that means is when I come to putting a book together, I'm usually working with poems that are three to five to seven or even years old. And when I come back to them, it's so easy to throw them away or chop them to pieces. Because when you have that kind of distance from them, you realize how stupid you were. And you just get to it. I very frequently rewrite old poems. I enjoy doing it. And by the way, because of this habit of writing a poem every day, I will tell people that I actually consider editing to be one of my I love the act of writing. It is my favorite thing. But the act of editing is an absolute joy to me now. I consider it a secondary form of creative writing. I can take this and I can make it better now. And everything that I puke is not gold. So get over it. The hardest thing to teach an undergraduate is that everything they write is gold. Oh. So, yeah. But yeah, I love editing. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious if I'm sorry.
He's got a good voice.
He does. And, young people today write very, very succinctly to the point that they don't even use words anymore. And I wonder if perhaps there's some chance that they will, once they figure out if there's something to say, that poetry will become more popular again. You started by mentioning how little poetry is read these days. And I wonder if there's some connection there that we might exploit.
Well, and by the way, it's not a joke when I say that poetry is the least popular literary sport, but, you know, whatever. The actual statistics, I mean, you know, tell us. It is the single lowest selling form of literature that there is. You can't, I mean, there's nothing you can do about those numbers. It's just fact. It's not a problem. On communication, that is a very typical... It's a very interesting thing. My daughter is a songwriter. She's a reader. She's an avid reader. She's 19. She does text. She is also quite eloquent. She is a good writer. This is a difficult question because here's what I teach professional writing. I taught for 15 years professional writing at OU. I'm going to give you two examples of things that I did. I told my students, if you communicate with me by email, I want you to know something. If you're going to bug me over email, there's something you need to know. I will first grade your email for grammar, punctuation, and spelling, and then I will return it to you. And then after you correct it, I will answer your email. So get ready for a communication process. The other thing that I tell my college students is much less threatening. I tell them quite straightforwardly. In the world that we live in, by the way, on the very basis for what I was talking about tonight, in a world that is awash with words, too many words, I told my college students all the way along, you have no idea the impact that learning to write a good, well-constructed, clear sentence will have on your entire life. When it comes to standing out in the crowd, it will determine whether or not you get the date, let alone the job. It will determine whether or not he or she marries you. It will you have no idea how just being able to construct a decent sentence, the impact that that will have on your life. I had some students who took me seriously, you know. But it's tough. My daughter is a good communicator. She's great with words. But she was raised on books and great songs and great music and, you know. I don't know what we do. I actually said the words, I feel bad about it now. I was the final panelist on an academic panel, you know, one of those kind of panel things where everybody's talking about the future of education. What do you think about the modern student? And I had heard all these unbelievably shiny things before me, and the cynic, came out of my mouth, you know, it came to me, and I said, my take on the modern college student, we're all going to die. I don't want to be cynical, and I keep teaching, and I keep trying, but I am going to be honest, the modern college student, today's college student scares me. I'm a little worried about the very thing that you asked about. I'm very concerned. Sorry, that was a little too long.
So I'm not still, even though I've had the microphone for several minutes, I'm still not exactly sure what my question is, but, you know, I think it goes something like this. I mean, some poems are clearly written just to enjoy the sound of the words. And, you know, is that part of the problem or part of the solution in terms of, you know, the lack of a popularity of poetry? Is that kind of thing, you know, kind of collapse of its own weight after a while? Is that best done in one page or shorter poems? And I would like to hear your take on that.
That's a great question, and I'm quite open to all forms of poetry, and I want people to always feel free to do what they want with it. I think what it is that I have been fighting for is that the academic poets and the language poets, who are very concerned, by the way, with what you said, the sound of the words. Just, it doesn't matter if they make sense. Now, I will say that when it comes to the language poets, very frequently my take on it, after having studied poetry for a long time, is that they took refrigerator magnets and threw them into a blanket and shook it and then wrote down what happened and called it poetry. If that is the case, then I don't care about the sound of their words. I don't care anymore. It's a difficult thing. There is poetry that is beautiful just for the sound of it. John Ashbery has pulled it off some, although I have read entire books of his where I never understood a single line. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what it is you even wanted to do with this book. I don't know what you're doing. But some of the lines were kind of beautiful. But what I'm saying is, why is it not okay? What I'm doing is I'm coming back at the academic poets and the language poets and saying, why is it that if I want to tell a story and I want to make sense, that's not okay? Because they do say that. As a matter of fact, I have been bashed by the Southern Literary Review. I've had the honor of being bashed by so many journals and blah, you know, whatever, that I simply write prose. I just make it look like poetry. I highly disagree with that. And that I am so that I'm too accessible, that's the bad word. If you're accessible, you're out. Academia will not have you in the poetry world. And what I'm saying is, look, you can go ahead, you can do your thing and not make sense. And maybe the sound of your words are pretty, but I also get to tell a story. You do not have the right to say what poetry is. I had a publisher in Chicago actually look at me over his desk one time and say, there's no such thing as narrative poetry.
Oh, God.
And I said, well, that counts out Ovid, Homer, Virgil, blah, and I just started going, you know, that counts out all of those guys. And I'm just saying, do your thing and let people not buy your books, but let me do my thing too. What I do is valid also. I don't know if that's a good answer to what you said, asked, but it's, you know, and I have read poetry that is quite beautiful that I don't quite get, but I stayed with it and eventually did get something out of it. So that's also tricky. That's also tricky. It's very tricky. It's very difficult. I just want to be able to do what I do because I write books that I would want to read. I don't know if that's selfish or I'm not sure.
Smart.
But I write books that I would want to read. And that's where my stuff comes from. And I just want to admit, by the way, because I am a folk musician, I have never recovered from it. Therefore, I sell CDs out of my trunk. I do have my books with me tonight, if anybody's interested in that at all. And because I have a 19-year-old daughter, I have also learned how to swipe credit cards in my phone. My daughter taught me how to do this, and I'm very grateful to her for it. And so if you're interested in a book or anything like that, just come see me. Thank you. Thank you so much.
We still have some.
One more question. I think you've kind of answered it. Part of my question is, well, how important is rhyme to poetry? And I think your answer is not important. But how would you distinguish poetry from prose or narrative?
I do. There's a quick answer to this, and we have a poem up here. It's so great. I can do this very quick. Tell people, I love rhyming poetry. Here are 8 lines from G.K. Chesterton. Listen to these wonderful lines from G.K. Chesterton. Though giant rains pour out the sun, here stand I for a sign. Though earth be filled with waters dark, my cup is filled with wine. To tell the trembling priests that here, under the deluge rod, one nameless, tattered, broken man stood up and drank to God. Oh, I love rhyming poetry. It's also much, much harder to write well. Otherwise, it just sounds like a toast by a drunk father at the wedding the night before who has written a rhyming poem because he's very torn up about the very questionable match for his daughter. And he doesn't know what to say at the wedding, and so he writes a bad rhyming poem for the wedding toast. Rhyming poem is very difficult to write well. So in free verse, which we would say is between rhyming poetry and prose. It's not prose. I sincerely, it's not prose. The poet is simply using the line breaks as a tool of storytelling. The line breaks are telling you where to pause in your reading. It's just like we would tell a story to a friend. There's a big difference between saying, you're not going to believe what he did next, and saying this, you are not going to believe what he did next. The poet is interested in the second version. Okay? And so what's happening is, William Carlos Williams here is just trying to tell us, this is very anti-American. The poet is telling us to slow down. That's not what Americans do. But he's saying pause. It is difficult to get the news from poems. Yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. He's showing you the way he wants the story told. That's what free verse is doing, and it's not prose. Is that kind of an answer? We can keep going afterwards. You can buy me another margarita.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No, I'll keep trying if that doesn't answer it. But
I have a segue on that question. I write some poetry too, and not nearly like in your category, but and I gave it to a friend poet, a poet of mine, Del Kane, and
I know
to
Del.
Critique.
He's a great guy.
And he said, read your poems out loud.
Yes. Yes.
And he said, poems don't have to rhyme, but they should flow like music. And
yes.
Since you're both a poet and a songwriter, kind of expand on that. That has to do, I think, you know, that kind of flowing.
Yeah, music had a big impact. I mean, the first part of I worked as a songwriter in Nashville for publishing companies in the first half of my, music was my first life. And I was writing music from the time I was 8 years old. It was really, really, really bad. But I was writing music all my life. And by my early 20s, I was working as a songwriter in Nashville. And then Nashville completely destroyed my love for music. It did. I mean, to the point, I burned out so bad that I came home from Nashville, never performed, sang, picked up a guitar, played a piano, nothing for 5 years. I didn't touch music. That's how bad Nashville burned me out. That TV show, Nashville, you know, I tell people, yeah, it's kind of like that, and there's a bad side. I'm now back into music and writing music again, but songwriting had a big impact on the way I write poetry. It is the sound and rhythm of language. So even if I'm not rhyming, I edit every single poem. I edit out loud. I read my poems out loud. Here's the best story I know of to go with that. The actor why am I blanking on his name, played Han Solo in Star Wars. What? Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford, George Lucas was writing the movie Star Wars, Harrison Ford actually went to George Lucas at one point and said, hey, by the way, while you're typing, read what you're writing out loud. It'll sure help us a hell of a lot. Apparently Harrison Ford was not pleased with George Lucas's dialogue. And he said, why don't you read out loud while you're typing? It'll really help us. And I think that's a good example. I do believe that poetry is at its best when performed well. It's frequently performed poorly, but when it's performed well, I believe it's an art form like songwriting. I think the actual encounter is the best part of poetry. It's my favorite part of poetry, is the actual encounter. So.
That fits real well with my next question,
okay,
which is that a few years ago, one of the standing room only longest lines I've ever seen college students have for a speaker was when Joaquin Sahuatanejo came to our college and
I've read with him. Yeah.
And had performance art, and he did such an incredible job, which I think you're speaking. He's certainly not brief in any way, but he is that kind of slam poetry, I think is what they call it. I would say is the renaissance for the young people.
Yeah, he is not typical slam poetry. Joaquin Sahuatanejo is a cross between slam poetry and classic theater. He is an actor. He is a master of delivery. And I'm telling you, he is one of the only poets I read before him, and then he went out, and who has left me standing in the back of a room in a blubbering heap. I was a mess after that guy read. And I've not had that reaction to anyone. What he does is very unique, even to the slam poetry world. He's not your typical, he's an actor. He is a theater actor. And he's,
you call him a poet?
Yeah, absolutely. Extraordinaire. Yeah, he is fantastic. From right here in Dallas, by the way. He's a much-loved high school teacher, I believe, here in Dallas. He's fantastic.
Students stood in line an hour
to
buy his book.
International slam champion. World, in other words, won the world championship of slam poetry. Yeah. He's incredible.
All right.
Love that guy.
Any other questions? Well, before we let Dr. Brown sit down, I want to present you a thank you from the Philosopher's Forum and from myself personally, my book of poetry. It's kind of, you know.
Excellent.
I'm a little book. You're a big professor here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
I love it. All right. Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.